Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. The U.S. COVID death toll stands at about 585,000 as the United States reopens and Europe makes progress on vaccinations. India remains in crisis, and everybody on the eastern seaboard grapple with an oil shortage in the wake of the ransomware attack on Colonial Pipeline that briefly closed the vital artery that ships energy from the Gulf Coast up the East Coast. Joining us to discuss all that and more, as they do every week, are Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Merrill Lynch, Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners in London, and Richard Abalafia of the Thiel Group Consultancy right here in Washington, D.C. Gentlemen, thanks very much for joining us as always.
Thanks, Vago.
Thank you, Vago.
Happy Sunday from Florida, Vago.
That's right. Richard, welcome. Welcome back to the traveling ranks. At this point, I feel badly for Sash. At this point, I've done two trips. You've now taken a trip. Hooray, you're in Florida. And Ron, you took a trip. So Sash, we're really counting on you one of these days to go somewhere.
Yeah, one of these days. I think that's the unit of measurement we're currently using over here.
Yes. Yeah, there it's a 14 month measure that involves a lack of airplanes. Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our cyber coverage and our weekly cyber report. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. General Motors Defense sponsors our technology coverage. And Rafael Advanced Defense Systems sponsors our air and missile defense coverage on this, the 10th anniversary of the Iron Dome system, which is now in operation in Israel to defend the population against Hamas rockets. Ron, start us off as you always do, right? I mean, broader market implications of the pipeline shutdown. Obviously, this extends beyond just people's ability to drive. I mean, I believe 88% of the gas stations in Washington, D.C. are out of gas. It's kind of spotty. There are some areas that are getting it. The pipeline was relatively briefly closed, right? So oil is moving again. The question is whether or not, you know, how quickly we can get it to gas stations, but this pipeline also supplies the commercial aviation industry, right? I mean, so talk to us a little bit about how the market is responding to all of this, because a lot of folks in the cyber community have a sense that this is the sort of thing that will drive home the importance of, you know, better cyber defenses. The administration released its cyber executive order. So, you know, talk to us about the week and some of these dynamics and how they drove how investors are thinking about things. And, you know, underlying this has been inflation concerns, given, you know, the United States is opening up rapidly and almost everybody had retooled production for a lower, more dormant rate, right? So, you know, almost every other sector of the economy is now trying to stand up and it's causing inflation pressure.
Yeah, so that's probably where I would start. I mean, the market has been more, I think, focused on inflation and the debate around, is this temporary or is it sticky? And if it's temporary, what does temporary mean? Is temporary just the summer? Or, you know, I think that's the big question in the market right now. And the pipeline issue kind of falls on maybe two fronts. One, you know, if you look at oil prices now, oil prices are in the mid 60s, depending on, you know, where you're looking, maybe a little higher. So we've seen oil prices, energy prices go up. That's part of the complex when you think about inflation. So it aggravated the inflation debate, one. And then two, the point you made on cyber, that of course comes up. But I would say even in the investment community that's focused on you know, aerospace and defense, I think they knew this, right? I mean, there's been a discussion in the investment community about cyber and the companies have talked about it. You know, one of the issues becomes when you want to invest in cyber, well, who, where, what? I mean, it's spread across different companies and it's hard to get at it as an investor, you know, as a clear play, if that makes sense. When you look at the broader market performance this week, you know, the S&P was down about 1.5%. Commercial aerospace was broadly down, yeah, similar to that. defense was roughly flat, maybe up a smidge, you know, broadly speaking. So defense was more defensive this week than commercial aerospace. And, you know, so it's, you've got these jitters in the market, but also remember the market's at or near highs. So you've seen some pullbacks there, and that's probably natural, you know, what's going on. So it's just, I think, helped fueled this broader debate around prices, inflation, and timing.
You know, obviously France, I think, has broken the 20% inoculation mark. Germany is moving. I think they're at 10%. Obviously, UK doing much better in the economy. You guys are, I think when we were talking, you mentioned you guys will be able to hug soon. So that's a good thing. But now, you know, very serious worries about the Indian strain of the virus that's now in the UK and a number of other countries, including the United States, which could be significantly more virulent and more problematic. And even Boris Johnson has said, look, we may have to reduce the span between the first and second shots in the UK. And folks are looking at whether or not the existing inoculations are actually going to be able to handle this. You know, where are we? Because, you know, as we've discussed on this program since the beginning of the pandemic, this works out if you sort of stop the pandemic everywhere. If you don't stop it everywhere, it's going to respread to places that may have thought they'd beaten it.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. You know, if you've got to have vaccination at both ends of the flight. Otherwise, you either can't get on the plane or you can't get off the plane. That's the, you know, and that's what's becoming very apparent from the growth trends and the lack of growth trends that we're seeing globally at the moment. You know, you've got a very strong recovery in the US. There's been a almost complete recovery in Chinese domestic traffic. But then you look at the other, you know, other markets. Brazil just sort of tanked in the first quarter, starting to recover now a bit. India is you know, falling very, very rapidly at the moment, and that has a knock on to all of the traffic from and to the Gulf. And Europe, very, very patchy indeed. Actually, a bit of an uptick last week, but you know, Europe is about a third of the level that it was at pre-pandemic in terms of travel. Because remember, almost all European flights are international by definition. They're not. There's no domestic market to speak of. Possible exception of you know, the really large companies, France, Germany, Spain, but you know, next to no domestic traffic worth speaking of. So it's a very, very patchy situation. The you know, vaccination is doing okay in Europe, actually. It's and I think what this shows is that, you know, there's pretty good supplies of the vaccines themselves, and the you know, the domestic systems that are handing them out are, you know, beginning to get up to speed. There is astonishing variation in the, some people would call efficiencies, other people would just call it the dynamics of the vaccination process from country to country, and sometimes even from city to city. So anybody that thinks that Europe is a sort of single, you know, integrated, almost amorphous region now, it really isn't. But yeah, you know, as the vaccination has picked up, you're starting to see the wave of coronavirus that really hit particularly France. But also Italy is starting to turn down. Hospitalizations are falling, and deaths are falling, and that's all terribly good news. You know, in the UK, vaccination program's gone pretty well. I think from Monday we're allowed to hug, which will be lovely. The concern now is what's been called the Indian variant, although actually there are three Indian variants, which was first identified back in late March, early April, and is starting to become a, you know, the dominant strain of the virus in some parts of the UK. And the question is going to be ultimately, you know, is it more transmissible? And if it is more transmissible, is it then more, frankly, more deadly? Or you know, is it something that the vaccines can deal with? It's spreading among young people. Most of them don't get it very badly, and we can continue to, you know, unwind the various lockdown processes. Boris Johnson, British Prime Minister, did a press conference last week where he said, you know, we can go to the next stage of unlocking the week coming, but we don't know whether the final stage in the third week of June will actually be able to go ahead or not. He's buying himself a lot of time. He's buying us all a lot of time to work out whether this Indian variant is as bad as some people say it is, or whether it is just one of the other variants vaccines can deal with it adequately. And every, you know, we've got to remember, vaccines aren't 100%. If vaccines work 70, 80% and 78% of people take them, that actually provides a pretty good way to address the virus. And that seems to have been working so far, you know, across most countries in Europe.
I do think the hugging is fine, although I think there are some people who are not particular big huggers who are very, very happy that hugging has stopped, although I think most people would say that they're happy that that's coming back. And then the big question of at what point and how you achieve whatever degree of herd immunity if a large portion of the population is either not vaccinated or decides not to be vaccinated. In the United States, we're stalling out because there are people who do not want to be vaccinated, and companies are now grappling with whether they require vaccinations. I think Delta is requiring vaccinations for new employees, but existing employees have some flexibility. In the military, this is considered an experimental vaccine. So as bizarre as it seems, there are a portion of military members who are not taking this because, again, it's an experimental vaccine. It can't be mandatory as a whole bunch of sort of authorized vaccinations are for military members, which I find bizarre.
I mean, just to pick up on that, the very interesting issue with this new Indian variant that has been spreading, and there are a couple of very localized, but pretty, you know, significant pockets of coronavirus generally in the northeast of England. And what is fascinating is that the variant seems to have, or the people being hospitalized now with this new variant, there's a very high percentage of them are people who, for cultural reasons, had turned down the vaccination, you know, 1 month, 2 months, 3 months ago. And paradoxically, what that is causing some people, you know, that's actually causing a bit of a pickup in vaccination acceptance by young people who previously didn't think they needed it. That's actually pretty good in terms of achieving herd immunity.
Look, at the end of the day, those who are not vaccinated will be at risk. And when, sadly, enough of them get sick and enough of them die, it may drive them to do this. I mean, that's the reason why in the past inoculations were mandatory. You had no opportunity to not get in, you know, vaccinated for smallpox, which was a deadly disease. Richard, let me bring you in. Upward rate pressure. Talk to us about how this return, certainly in the United States, but elsewhere in the world, is driving production rates, and what our friends in Toulouse have to say about it, and what it means for our friends in Chicago and Seattle.
Yeah, I think both are important issues. Because they're doing two things. One, of course, is taking advantage of the recovering markets, particularly in the U.S., by building more planes and bringing in more revenue. But they're also emphasizing that they've got this strong and growing competitive advantage in single aisles over in Toulouse. So they've come up with a plan to get to 45 this year, which is certainly higher than most people thought they would get. Lots of talk of well into the 50s next year. And, you know, there's really not much of a prospect of the max moving up to this extent. And they also emphasize the reason for their competitive advantage by basically returning to their earlier plan of converting the completely useless at all stages of its pathetic existence A380 line to an A321 line, which would, of course, be extremely useful. And that's only going to exacerbate the difference in single aisle market standing between Airbus and Boeing when this thing comes online in the next couple of years. So it's nothing but, I think, optimism from Toulouse's perspective, and I think greatly puts the pressure on Boeing, you know, yet again, to think about its future.
I didn't think that you would be able to kick the 380 at this point with both feet simultaneously, but you managed to do that and still remain standing up, which was pretty amazing. Which was pretty amazing.
That's very good.
Colonial Pipeline. Are we going to see an impact on ticket prices on this, right? I mean, there isn't an airline known to humanity that hasn't managed to take advantage of any perturbation in fuel price. Right now, we've got demand that's hot in the United States. We have fuel prices that will be going up. Latest, you know, for some people, it was a brief interruption But now there are some people saying that because of panic buying and a whole bunch of other things, this may drive sort of a 2-week shortage of fuel. Significant needle mover, not a needle mover. Anybody can feel that. If you want to start, Richard, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, I doubt it. You know, I mean, I think at this point, given the fragile nature of the recovery, people are loath in the airline business to try to, you know, take advantage of any additional pricing power they might have as a consequence of a fuel shortage, if indeed that, you know, that's going to persist. And, you know, the other question, of course, is isn't this temporary? You know, already the pipeline's flowing again. You know, there's just not a lot you can do in terms of airline ticket prices to leverage this.
Sash?
Yeah, so I just wanted to pick up on the A321 line at Toulouse. That it seems to me that, yeah, it's fantastic for Airbus to get some more A321 capacity because they've arguably had far too many eggs in the Hamburg basket. And therefore, when Hamburg has any sort of problems, that massively restricts Airbus's ability to actually ship their best-selling aircraft at the moment. But there's actually, I think Airbus is sending quite a powerful signal as well with the decision to convert the A380 line and arguably add capacity for the A321, you know, at a fairly early stage in the upswing. What they're actually saying is there's no demand for wide bodies. And if they don't put some business in Toulouse, Toulouse has got a lot of very underemployed people, not just on the former A380 line. We, you know, that they've already demanded that. But really, they're not producing A350s or A330s in any sort of numbers at the moment, probably 6 a month max. And that was those were, you know, the historic peak for those was 20. You know, putting more business in Toulouse, they've got to do that just to keep employment up there and balance the system a bit better. And it's telling you the wide-body market isn't going to recover anytime soon.
Ron, on oil and production thoughts?
Yeah, so on oil, I mean, I think, you know, to Richard's point that, I mean, you know, how temporary is this, right? I mean, the pipeline's flowing again, so on and so forth. And then I agree with Richard's point that airlines would be loath to try to, you know, raise prices in, you know, potentially sensitive markets, so on and so forth. Now, if this is somehow longer lasting, back to the inflation point, ultimately it'll get passed through to passengers, right? It kind of has to. But just specifically around, you know, the pipeline issue, I don't see that as a big factor on, you know, ticket pricing, in, at least in the short term.
And I should point out, right? I mean, fuel prices were rising a little bit anyway, because more and more people were out, more and more people were driving. Although, you know, the number of people who are still on the roads are relatively low because a lot of agencies of the U.S. government aren't going to go back to the office until, you know, around Labor Day, right? So, or I think it's after Labor Day. Talk to us a little bit about 737. And where we are with the electrical issues, some news flow on that, and the Federal Aviation Administration putting a directive out on 777 engine mounts. So let's just use this as an opportunity to bring everybody up to speed on where Boeing is on sort of putting some of its production challenges behind it and some of its airworthiness challenges behind it as well.
Well, there's a couple things, right? So, you know, the FAA put out a directive on the electrical issue that showed up in the MAXs, but then they also put out a directive demanding inspections of 737 classics just to make sure, I guess, that the what happened with the 737 classic crash in Indonesia, they, I guess, identified issue there. So that's sort of a put and a take, right? And then on 777, there was also, as you pointed out, an airworthiness directive on the engine. I think it was engine mount. I'm not as close to that one. But to some extent, this is sort of, you know, normal due course of business with an airframer, right? I mean, there's airworthiness directives that kind of come and go all the time, right? So, you know, from that perspective, you know, it kind of is what it is, right? And when you think about, you know, the kind of broader, you know, question for Boeing, it kind of always comes back to the same point. You know, they're talking about getting to, you know, 31 per month on 737s by the beginning of 2022. And the question becomes, you know, where to from there? And that's a function of, you know, market placement vis-a-vis the A321 family of aircraft. And you know, as we've stated before, and you know, I think most everybody in this call would agree, right, that or this podcast would agree, I mean, you know, do we end up with a situation where it's, you know, 60-40 Airbus Boeing in the narrow body market, right? So that's what we're watching.
Sash?
I mean, you know, just on, while we're covering all matters Boeing, very interesting comment from Rolls-Royce this week. They had their annual general meeting. Chief Executive Warren East, you know, gave a sort of a tour d'horizon of the business and the industry wide. Most interesting thing I thought was that he said that Rolls-Royce is now back talking to Boeing about powering the next aircraft. Now, you know, we talked, and Ron alluded to it just now, about what the next aircraft might be, should be. Is it going to be a small wide body, or should they, as I think probably the consensus is among us, actually do a, you know, a large narrow body direct compete with the A321? But, you know, Rolls have pulled out of this race altogether 18 months ago, when Boeing was still talking about the NMA, a medium airliner, and they said, well, we can't get the engine available for what was then the NMA's planned in-service date of 2025, however preposterous you and I think that is. That was the target. Clearly now, the new Boeing aircraft, whatever it is, it has got a in-service date that entirely matches Rolls-Royce's hoped ability to deliver the UltraFan engine. And that's very interesting. So that means we're going to be back with a three-way race for the next Boeing aircraft. I would say that net, that's bad news for GE. GE, you know, is pretty much the incumbent on every major Boeing platform, or they're the leader on most of them. And I think having a three-way race is going to put, you know, there's got to be the risk that GE doesn't do as well as they have done in the past.
Richard?
You know, Rolls-Royce really needs this to happen. A lot of people need this to happen. Lessors need this to happen to avoid giving Airbus de facto monopoly pricing power on the 321neo, especially the XLR. Ditto for the airlines. Everyone needs this to happen. So it's not surprising that Rolls-Royce is talking about this. It helps them revisit that disastrous IAE exit thing they did 10 years ago. IA exit, I guess, to put it in Brexit terms. You know, everyone needs this to happen. So everything but the, oh, right, Boeing. I mean, there is absolutely no talk from Boeing of this happening. Instead, you know, last year they cut IRAD by 27%. Those are the people who would be designing this plane. And as we've said before, Calhoun now owns this problem. You know, whether it happens or whether it doesn't happen, that is to say, whether Boeing has a future or does not, that is purely on him. Because of the recent management changes. So this is going to be fascinating to watch. I hope Rolls-Royce is speaking about something that really is bubbling behind the scenes, but I fear that it might not be.
And so how does GE respond to this, right? I mean, the Pratt & Whitney guys have the geared turbofan. We're going to have UltraFan coming out of Rolls-Royce.
They've got to do a geared fan because... you know, a variant of LEAP or a variant of GE9X, you know, derivative in some way, just isn't going to cut the mustard. Interestingly, their partner in LEAP, Safran, has said in the past, you know, we're starting to look at a geared fan, which is, you know, that's almost heresy, that is, because that implies that they see LEAP as being a transitional engine on narrow bodies. But GE is going to have to, they're going to have to stump up their share of the R&D as well and accept that, you know, some form of gearing is the future.
Well, remember about, I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No, go on.
Remember about 5 or 6 years ago, GE purchased Avio in Italy. And of course, they do the planetary gearbox for the C-Series, then 220 now. Engine for Pratt & Whitney. And it's, you know, what did they do with that intellectual property? In theory, it was firewalled. Pratt & Whitney at the time said, yeah, we're scratching our heads about this. I think that was a direct quote. No one seemed to quite know. And well, basically, if there is something that they've been able to harvest out of that, they could already be working on it. The problem, of course, is that the old Bank of GE model, where they own GECAS and they've got such a fantastic balance sheet, that's not in play anymore.
It's going to be very interesting because I remember having conversations with senior Safran management who were looking at that issue and when's the right time to be making that and where GE was going to be on it and whether GE was going to be able to make that investment, which I thought were some interesting discussions at the time. Let me, well, there are two issues I want to discuss, Iron Dome as well as Air Taxi. Let's briefly talk about Air Taxi and then spend some time talking a little bit about Iron Dome. Steve Dixon, Federal Aviation Administrator, said, told Congress that 2023 is when air taxi permits are going to start being issued. He expects flights to start in 24 or the following year. In the UK, we've got, I think it's Air Hub, if I'm correct, in one hub in Coventry that has some government backing, doing exactly what Sash has been saying, right? The air traffic management is the key enabling part of this if you're going to be doing this. And it appears there's a lot of money, a lot of SPAC activity, irrespective of how annoying we might find air taxis. This is a lot closer than maybe people think it is, isn't it?
From a technological from a technological standpoint, it certainly seems to be advancing somewhat nicely. From an economic standpoint, it's still completely bonkers. You know, we now have more SPAC filings. The Lilium SPAC filing is majestic, and all of it makes the same ridiculously over-optimistic assumptions that were made for air taxis, horizontal takeoff air taxis, back 15 years ago with Eclipse and Dayjet and Sats Air and all this other stuff that happened then. And it did indeed happen before, of course, it all died because the economics were bonkers then. They're bonkers now. And the only question I would have for anybody who's looking forward to flying in an advanced air mobility vehicle is, how often are you given exclusive access to a machine that costs probably about $4 million? It doesn't happen very often to me.
Ron, Sash?
I think when you look at these, excuse me, when you look at these models, and it's, I think it can be easy to overlook. The operating cost of, just call it an eVTOL aircraft, just the generic eVTOL. And let's assume one vertical takeoff landing, but can, you know, has a wing so it can, you know, forward flight at a reasonable speed. And you look at it in a lab, I think you can argue that the operating cost is less, maybe even significantly less. But once you put it out in the real world, so think about it for a moment. If you want to operate an air taxi from lower Manhattan to JFK, you've got to deal with your pilot costs, right? So unless you're flying autonomously, which isn't here yet and probably won't be for a while, and you know, rightfully so, I would imagine the FAA is going to be kind of slow on that, particularly in an urban environment. You have labor costs. Then you've got things like landing fees. So I would imagine if you look at, you know, a helicopter flying from lower Manhattan out to JFK, probably a big chunk of the cost in that flight is just the landing fee out at JFK. When you overlay all that on top of one of these aircraft, most likely the operating cost in a somewhat conventional operation isn't all that different. That would be my guess, right?
Right.
And then the next step, when you think about, all right, are we going to have, you know, vertiports all over the place and people flying around and the sky's darkened with these things? I think it's very easy because it's, you know, it's exciting, it's a future, it's really kind of cool to just sort of get a little ahead of your skis on that sort of thing. That's going to take a really long time to fall into place because of infrastructure investments. One big part in just regulatory investments and how does the whole operating environment kind of work, so on and so forth. So I'm bullish on the electrification of aircraft and the implications that electric propulsion systems have for aircraft. I think there's some really fascinating things that are going to happen, and things will potentially change on some level because of that. But I'm a little more conservative, a little more guarded when you think about, you know, the sky being darkened, you know, just sort of conceptually, you know, a world where everybody's flying around in little vehicles like the Jetsons. That's going to take a while, if ever.
I mean, one of the questions that I have is, as autonomy improves for automobiles, that becomes then the game changer for any of the range distances that we might be talking about. So if I can get in my autonomous driving car, settle in comfortably to watch a movie and then get some sleep and show up in Maine tomorrow, that, I mean, isn't that going to take away from some of these short hop, right? I mean, why wouldn't you drive for some of these distances as opposed to even taking the train or other things?
Let me push back on you on that one.
Sure.
So right now you can, well, presumably post-pandemic, pre-pandemic, you know, you could get on an aircraft in Newark, a nice new A350, sit in a comfortable business class on Singapore Airlines, and 18 hours later land in Singapore, right? You can nap, you have a nice meal, you can take a couple naps. You know, if we had
you were on, having done that flight, you are so bored, you don't even know what to do for a
while. You're bored to tears.
Right? I mean, you're just, there isn't enough entertainment to keep
16
you.
Hours in, you're like, holy smokes, we have two more. All right. If you had a hypersonic aircraft and you could get to Singapore in 3 hours, yeah, you would take that.
Right.
And I think you would even be less comfortable to get there quicker. Right. So, you know, getting in a self-driving car and spending the night to get to Maine, I don't know. I mean, my sense is the time to get there, it matters, right? Overflying traffic and all that. I think that really, really does matter. So, you know, in my case, commuting into Manhattan, you know, if I could get into Manhattan in, you know, from my neighborhood, if you will, my local vertiport, say it's, you know, a couple miles from my house, and get into sort of midtown Manhattan and do that in half an hour, you know, I would do that all day long.
Right. I think Maine might not have been a good example. I'm just saying that once it's self-driving and you don't have to worry about the driving of it and it gets you there for these shorter haul distances, I have a little bit of difficulty looking at that and going like, okay, wait a minute. So this is going to work out really, really well for some of these short distances. And eventually the economics will, and it'll be considered cool. And right, I mean, there will be novelty to it, a little bit like a Tesla, right? I mean, I think in the very beginning, people were like, oh, this is just a rich guy's novelty. Then it becomes an appliance, right? It has the range. It's got the comfort. It's got the cool factor. And then all of a sudden people want to own it. And then everybody else in the industry looks at it and goes, holy crap, we've got to be involved in that. Sasha, I want to bring you into the discussion as well.
I'll get your
sense before we go to Iron Dome.
Sure. I'll pick up on your last point. I think it's a really good point about how different modes of transport actually overlap and substitute with each other. That, you know, in Europe, one of the things that really damaged and has damaged regional air travel compared to in the US for equivalent distances has been the existence of high-speed trains. Once you have a good high-speed train network, you don't need to fly. And, you know, you'll remember we talked about a month ago about the policy that the French government is now being forced to bring in, where any journey that would take more than 2.5 hours in France has to be done by train. You can't have a flight providing the equivalent linkage, because they just say trains are more environmentally friendly. We shouldn't, as a country, be sponsoring short distance flying. And I think that there will be this tension, competition between ground transport or autonomous ground transport and needs to be autonomous air taxi flights. And it will, you know, this is one of the things that makes me very, very skeptical about the some of the modeling of the potential market for air taxi type services. Just to come, you know, very quickly to the, you know, the UK government has a future flight challenge. I mean, this is, you know, just a relatively small thing, but I mean, they the winner of this was the Air One Urban Airport, and it's a teaming between Urban Airport, Hyundai Motor Group, Coventry City Council, looking at, you know, future vertiports. I've got to say, you look at the pictures of this, it's just a rather well-painted parking lot. And right. The innovation, you know, what they're focusing on is electrification, i.e. repowering, refueling electric-powered aircraft. They haven't thought, and they're not thinking one iota about what happens when these things actually take off, rise above 250 feet and join, you know, the air mass that at that stage starts to become very, very chaotic and very, very busy. And I mean, my view has been and continues to be that nowhere near enough attention is being placed on air traffic management, and far too much focus being placed on doing nice, shiny, smooth shaped carbon fiber things. Anybody can do those. You know, molds in carbon fiber are generic, but actually making that thing work in three dimensions plus a lot of speed, that's the challenge, and nobody's yet looked at that.
Richard, you want to close this out and very quickly get everybody's take on Iron Dome?
Yeah, I mean, I've got, it just seems that we're making a big mistake pumping all of this cash into advanced air mobility rather than the traditional components of the aerospace industry that are poised to benefit from what I think will be a pretty substantial upturn. So I would expect to see significant losses in the years ahead, just like we did in the second half of the 2000s after the original air taxi and very light jet catastrophes.
I still think, as much as I'm a fan of speed, I think that when you get to an autonomous driving situation, that's going to change the dynamics of this as well. I mean, if you consider that if you're somebody on Eastern Long Island, you're either flying on a private jet, or you've got to go to Islip, or if you want to have some choice, you've got to go all the way to LaGuardia or to Kennedy to fly out, which just makes it kind of an onerous situation. But you could see some places that it makes quite a lot of sense. If you can just automate some of these routes and you electrify them, it takes maintenance out of it, it takes manpower out of it, it takes drivers out of it, and it arguably could make the experience safer. And then it, as how people are looking at these networks, you wouldn't even buy it. You just have the service of a car. So it is like an Uber-like thing. It could be a subscription thing where the pod takes you to wherever you need to go, and you don't even have to worry about buying the pod, right? You just book the pod. You book the pod with dinner and a movie, right?
This all sounds great. But of course, you've also got the issue of, you know, Robinson R22s or 44s or whatever. They're plenty cheap from a seat mile cost standpoint. Why not just prove it with autonomous versions of those rather than create these rather overly elaborate bespoke air vehicles?
Right. Well, that's what I'm saying, right? You may not necessarily need them from an air as aircraft, rather, as part of, I think as Sash was saying, and we've been saying, as part of like a whole transportation infrastructure. Iron Dome, who wants to start on this? Obviously, sponsoring our air and missile defense coverage, but the footage, you know, anybody who's been aware of the system has known about its extraordinary qualities. Those of us who have friends in Israel have sent us footage of its extraordinary response to incoming guided rockets, missiles, and artillery, the likes of which we're seeing coming out of Gaza and landing in points all over Israel. A smart system that sort of figures out what to shoot at and when. Ron, you said a former colleague of yours had sent you a pretty cool video, and you were just talk to us about the video and what you guys thought of it, and just want to quickly go around, because I think that there's a recognition that as we go into this future, precision will be used against U.S. forces as well. And not everything Hamas is shooting is an unguided pipe with some fins on it.
Yeah, I was in that video. It was pretty remarkable. It was a video that they took outside of I think it was their living room window. And you could see, it was at night, obviously, and you could see, kind of the trail from the missile or rocket, whatever you want to call it, being shot. And then the Iron Dome system taking them out, and it looked very reminiscent of just a video game. I mean, it was pretty remarkable, I really hadn't seen anything quite like it, kind of in action deployed, right? So yeah, it really does seem like a pretty remarkable technology.
And it shoots at what it has to shoot at, right? I mean, if it deems that something's going to land in a parking lot, or it's not necessarily a threat to human life, it's smart enough to not shoot at it. And Sash, your sense, because for you the economics are really
I think the economics of Iron Dome is actually what makes it a really, really brilliant system. I mean, as you said, it only shoots at what it has to. So if you think if a warship is being fired at by an anti-ship missile, it will either shoot, look, shoot, or shoot, shoot, look, or, and it will just keep on firing missiles that cost anything from $1 million upwards until it hits. Now, that's fine because you're protecting a billion-dollar ship, but it's astonishingly expensive. Iron Dome does not shoot unless it calculates that the incoming rocket, and remember, it's an anti-rocket system, that the incoming rocket system rocket is going to hit something of value, i.e. something that has got people in it. So it immediately applies a value and economic judgment. I think that is absolutely fascinating. We've all got something to learn from that. And then the second thing I think is fascinating is that they've got the cost of the interceptors down so that they can produce and fire tons of them. You don't have to worry when your cost of the interceptor is in five figures rather than seven. And again, every missile company has got something to learn from that, because otherwise wars of attrition get lost by the side that can least afford them. And if you're, you know, if you price yourself out of the market in terms of the exquisite cost of your missile system, you will eventually lose an attritional war. I think getting the cost of the interceptors down is absolutely brilliant, personally.
And I think it's been reported that it's about $10,000 per round. Although we're going to be welcoming some folks from Rafael to join us and talk to us about the system, but they've observed to us that they're a little bit busy right now.
Yeah. I mean, Richard, look, even if it was five times that, that is cheaper than a Javelin anti-tank missile. Go figure.
Richard?
No, I think it's one of the more brilliant technical responses, but of course, you know, let's not make any mistakes. These are not really ballistic threats. And the big question, I think, is to what extent can the technology be extrapolated and harvested and used against ballistic threats? And jury's out on that, best of my knowledge.
The folks at Israel Aerospace Industries would say that with the Arrow, they've broken the cost curve for a much less expensive intercept. And it's a technology that U.S. contractors are focused on as well, because obviously the Pentagon wants defenses against sort of the layered kind of systems the Chinese are fielding, particularly in the Pacific. And you are on the wrong side of the cost curve if every single one of your... I mean, it's very good if you're the manufacturer of... multi-million, $10 million missiles, but you ideally want to be on the more affordable side of that cost curve. Guys, thanks very, very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Look forward to having you guys back on again next week. In the meantime, have a great week and talk to you then.
Always great to be here, Vago. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks so much, Vago.
Really appreciate it, Vago. Thanks very much.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost nine decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.